qui saignait du nez après qu'il soit rentré dans une porte patio fermée, sans rire de lui?
Évidemment.
Avec ton empathie, tu as de l'avenir en santé et services sociaux. Trouve ta place sur québec.ca/carrière en santé. Un message du gouvernement du Québec.
I'm Julia Kent, and you're listening to CKUT 90.3 FM, Montreal.
Hello, and welcome to the All Things Palestinian podcast, a project of Canadians for Justice and Peace in the Middle East. Together, we dive into the realm of what it means to be Palestinian. We explore all aspects of Palestinian culture and art, as well as history and politics, to encourage Palestinian pride and engagement. Today, we are joined by Fargo Tebechi, a queer Palestinian-American writer and performance artist who explores themes of erasure and colonization and imagines a new reality for a liberated Palestine. My name is Tom Woodley. I'm co-host of the All Things Palestinian podcast, and I'm filling in today for Rafif Tejani, who's away on holiday. And normally I would be joined by our co-host Tyla Shahr, but she unfortunately has been sick for a few days and actually feverish. So our sympathies go out to Tyla, and Tyla, we wish you a quick recovery. Can't wait to have you back with us, but we're going to forge ahead, and we're thrilled, as I mentioned earlier, to have Fargo Tebechi with us today. He's an up-and-coming Palestinian diaspora figure, so I'll just introduce him. Fargo is a queer Palestinian-American writer and performance artist based in Washington, D.C., and winner of the 2018 Ghassan Kanafani Resistance Art Prize. His writings have been published in various literary publications, including the Berkeley Review, among others. He's also the recipient of several fellowships. Fargo's writings and performance challenges notions of erasure and colonization, and they propose a reality of a free and unoccupied Palestine. So welcome, Fargo.
Thank you very much for having me. I'm glad to be here.
Yeah, well, appreciate you're taking the time. And I was looking, of course, doing a little poking around on the internet the past few days and learning more about you in advance of this interview. And you're obviously forward-thinking, cutting-edge artist, and bringing to the fore these issues that are so important to all of us. But let's start at the beginnings. Where in Palestine are you from?
Yeah, my father's family is from El Khalil, and his father worked making the chassis for the back of trucks. So they would make, it was a lot of wood and metalwork, these really large kind of things that would hold objects that were transported. And in 67, they lost their land and so moved to Amman in Jordan, which is where my father grew up. Okay. And then he came to the United States to work in the 90s, and that's where he met my mother. And so I was born here in the States, in California.
Well, let's talk a little bit. Of course, you grew up in Phoenix, Arizona. What are your best memories of your time there, and what are some of the more difficult ones?
It's a good question. I liked Phoenix actually quite a bit. As I said, I was born in California, and when I was about 12, my family and I moved to Arizona just because it was cheaper, and the cost of living in California was going up and up, and it was harder to, especially for my mom, who really raised me and my siblings by herself in large part. Phoenix took some adjusting to, but it's a place that I've grown to really love and miss in a lot of ways. It's really beautiful. You know, the desert is a really lovely place to be, especially when it's not the summer and 120 degrees. So Phoenix was it's a really interesting city, and it's going through a lot of changes right now, especially for some reason. It's kind of becoming a hub where people move, and cost of living is going up there as well, which is, you know, true for many places in the United States. But for some reason, Phoenix has a kind of focus right now. Yeah. Growing up, And in general, much of my sense of my Palestinian-ness, you know, and that aspect of identity is really connected to my father. Yeah. And so there are a lot of complications and sort of nuances within that relationship, especially at that time, right, when I was growing up in Arizona. My father lives in Jordan, and that is partially due to the complications and machinations of law in the United States, and troubles in and out of trouble with the law, and so that absence, which was and was not a fault of anyone's, I suppose, made I think my relationship to thinking about Palestine and thinking about Arabness in Phoenix complicated in a lot of ways. It's a word I'm coming back to, even though I generally don't like that word. But so I'm thinking about visibility a little bit and community in Phoenix in terms of Palestinians. There were other small pockets of Palestinian Americans and Palestinians that lived there that I was able to connect to in various ways. But this central tension between that sort of shaped the relationship between me and my father and me and notions of Palestinian identity, I think, led to me really wanting to and needing to take time to understand how to talk about that before I started making work, especially, but even just kind of openly talking about Palestine and my place within its diaspora. And so for me, I'm thinking a little bit about visibility and sort of this need sometimes and the value of claiming our identity for sure. But I think that also comes with a lot of costs very often. Yeah. And I think that it's very, very easy for our expressions of Palestinian identity to be taken up in ways that we don't intend. And forced into a larger national discourse that it's very hard to get out of. Yeah. So for me, because it is so deeply bound up with my relationship with my father, I had to really first learn how to talk about that relationship and how to talk about him in ways that did not give him up to a kind of discourse that would minimize his humanity. Mm. It's a little bit vague, I suppose, the things that I'm talking about, but I'm sort of trying to, I think, communicate that it really was about, for me, finding language that couldn't be co-opted to describe what it means to me to be Palestinian and what it means to me to think about that relationship coming from my father. So all of that for me is really bound up in the time that I was growing up in Phoenix. And it's a place where I hold a lot of that pain, but also a lot of the community relationships and mentors and teachers that gave me the language I needed to be able to talk and make work and engage in ways that didn't feel icky, for lack of a better word.
Yeah. How did you become interested in writing and performance art and poetry?
Yeah, I've always been drawn to those things in various forms ever since I was very, very young, which I think is a stock answer for a lot of, especially performers, who will say, when I was 5 years old, I was putting on shows for my family. And, you know, in a lot of ways, I think that's just being a child. But I certainly did that. And I think it really started taking the shape or starting to take the shapes that it takes now. When I was in college, I started in a more traditional theater space. You know, that's really where I come from is acting on stage. And coinciding with a lot of those internal changes and conversations that we were just talking about in regards to identity and the things that comes with it, the necessities and commitments that I think come with really engaging and embracing a particular identity. Those things really coincided with, for me, some disillusionment with the kind of theater that I was making at the time. And so I started to be curious about ways that I could use performance and the things I loved about it to engage with the world in ways that these other parts of my life were starting to necessitate for me. Yeah. And the thing that really broke that open in many ways was finding performance studies, which in the space that I encountered, it really emerges from the field of communications and looking at performance as a way of being in the world, and the especially the ways that our identities take shape and are reified and made concrete in the ways that I see someone perform Palestinian, for example, and I learn that that is a script for how to be Palestinian. And these things emerge from all sorts of spaces. They emerge from our communities and our families, but also from the kinds of discourses that emerge from the United States and from the media and from news. And so there's a lot of conflicting performances. And for me, thinking about my own love of performance as a space and a genre where things are not stable opened up the possibility for negotiating different meanings for identity and creating new shapes and new performances and new scripts for what that might mean for myself as a body in the world. So really, I started to think about myself as a subject and a performer to write through and with. And at the same time, I really started writing poetry more seriously. I had written poetry in high school that was awful, truly, truly horrible. and along with this new interest in finding a more theory-based, a more critically rigorous form of performance, it also led me to revisit forms of writing that I hadn't taken on in a while. And so, you know, even just going back to our earlier conversation, I think finding for myself the language that felt right and accurate and sharp enough to describe who I was and to describe what that meant for me made it possible to revisit spaces like performance and poetry, which are slippery in a way that I think is very, very useful. They operate in ways that can step outside of more stable meanings in the world, of things that are rigid. And that was very valuable to me at that time and still remains valuable. So there was really, I think, for myself, when I was, you know, 18 or 19, a kind of explosion of being able to merge these new understandings of myself with the forms of expression that I had always loved. And so that's really, I would locate that as the start of the trajectory of work that I've been making for the past few years.
I think people who haven't, what's the word for it, sort of people who don't have sort of divided identities. Myself, I grew up in North America. I've lived here, apart from vacations and the occasional trip abroad, I've lived my whole life in North America. And I think, and my parents were born in North America. And I think people with sort of split identities or multicultural identities, they go through things, obviously, that many people don't.
Yeah, but even to go back to your experience, I think it's useful sometimes to look at the ways that all of us are already born into some kind of shape of those expectations. For example, the shape that you are born into as someone who is very connected to North America, for example, your identity as an American is predefined in so many ways for you. Yeah. And all of these relationships that we have in the world start to and continue to shape what that means. Yeah. And the same thing is true for you as it is for other Palestinians, although the dynamics and kinds of performances that are demanded of you are different than are demanded of me or are demanded of someone who is a Palestinian living in Palestine, for example. But they all share a network, a circulating network of demands and expectations and predefined shapes. And so the idea, I think, of performance for me, and a lot of times, I think, especially now when we talk about performance or things that are performative, we mean that to mean false or inauthentic, which is not how I understand the word. I understand it really to be about the fact that these demands and shapes of what it means to be a certain thing are written for us, but they are not true in a kind of objective meaning of the sense. They are not the clothes that we have to wear throughout the rest of our life. They are not the performances we have to continue to live inside of. And so for me, what's really exciting about thinking of performance, for example, as a way of understanding those kinds of demands or expectations is that it means they're not stable. It means that I can go off script. It means that I can improvise and find ways to step outside of the stages that have been set for me as a person, as a Palestinian, as a man, as someone who it was also born and raised in North America, for example. So, I think it's about knowing that we get to decide for ourselves every day and re-decide what it means to be who we are and what that entails and what that necessitates about who we are with others as well, right? Yeah. That it's not an individual thing, but who I am as a Palestinian is deeply involved and intertwined with who I am in relationship to my Palestinian peers and communities and people I disagree with about what this means, right? Yeah. There's a kind of essentializing nature that comes with so many of these expectations of the way that we're talked about that I think can be really harmful and really flattening and reductive.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, there are two things that occurred to me as I hear you. It's one is that, first of all, not everyone sees it. Not everyone understands that they're living in a mold and they have the right to break out. And then a lot of times when people do realize that they're living in a mold and they have the possibility of breaking out, they don't have the courage to do so. So it's sort of there's two key steps that you've gone through in that. Now, I know that you've found a way to actually combine both your poetry and your performance. And I guess we wanted to ask you a little bit about sort of how does this work? Do you start with the poem or do you start with the concept for the performance or are they sort of in parallel? And how does that creative process work for you?
Yeah. Generally, the way that I describe the relationship between these two elements, because they are very tied together for me, performance and poetry. A lot of times, especially in performance studies spaces, we think of, for example, poetry as a particularly performative kind of writing, which is to say that on the page, poems move in a way that prose, for example, doesn't. Poems are in a more slippery space, which kind of blurs a lot of boundaries that are less blurry in other forms of writing. And so it's useful sometimes to think about poetry as already a kind of performance.
True.
And at the same time, poetry emerges from so many of these oral traditions, especially in Arabic lineages of poetry. It's very much an oral art form, performative art form that depends on someone's breath and someone's voice animating it to allow it to move the way that it does. So for me, I think about a lot of my work as attempting to break the languages that the world uses, very sort of broad and vague in some ways. But I try to do that first on the page with poetry. I try to find ways of creating lines and shapes for poems that can accomplish that breakage, that rupture in, as we've been talking about, these defined boundaries of what the world is meant to be. And sometimes it happens on the page. Sometimes I feel that I've accomplished that sort of rupture. And sometimes it seems to me that the language on the page can't go quite far enough. And so at that time, I'll turn to performance as an additional set of tools to bring the poem into different relationships with other people, especially. Yeah. So that's obviously a big difference between poetry and performance generally. is that when I write and publish a poem online, for example, my experience of someone reading that poem is diffused and detached. There's a way in which I won't really ever know how someone reacts if they're reading it on their phone somewhere 200 miles away, versus when I'm performing for an audience of people whose faces I can see, whose breaths I can hear. That's a very immediate sort of not just feedback, but relation. I'm in relationship with you in the room in a way that is different than how I'm in relationship with you as the author of a poem you're reading just as words on a screen. So sometimes what a poem is trying to do necessitates that more intimate relationship, which is when I might turn to performance. For me, just generally, I think that performance is such a valuable set of tools to amplify and shift and change what poems are trying to do by themselves, that when I introduce my body in a space to the words that I've already written, there are so many other ways that I can say, this poem is trying to do this bit of rhetorical move, for example. Mm-hmm. And if my only tools are words on a blank page, I'm limited in how I can accomplish that move. But when I bring them into performance and say, I can also think about how movement can clarify this goal, I can think about how the volume and tone of my voice amplifies this goal, I can think about what it means to perform this poem for 20 people in a room, for 200 people in a room, for one single person in a room. All of these become different ways of, again, accomplishing that breakdown of these predefined moments of language, these oppressive languages and forms of conversation that is very, very difficult to step outside of. Yeah. So a lot of times in a sort of more practical sense, I start with text because that's just how I work best, I find. Mm-hmm. And then it's a lot about understanding what the text is trying to do and then wondering how performance can amplify that, or how performance can even poke at that a little bit and say, is that really what you want to do? Is that really what you're trying to do? Being open to the kinds of unexpected shifts and changes that emerge when you put a poem in your breath, when you put a poem in your voice and your body, that you might not have ever known to look for when you're stuck looking at it on a laptop. Yeah. So poetry and performance are very much connected and intertwined for me, and they always have been. And so I think they're kind of two sides of the same coin, and I also look at them as things that support and change each other.
Yeah. Yeah, yeah. You know, it's you're right. I mean, obviously, when artists you go to bookstores where an author will do a reading, but there is obviously much more. I'm not an expert on this, but it seems to me that there's a lot of interest in poetry readings, a disproportionate interest in poetry readings versus nonfiction or fictional readings. And it's certainly right, because there's that element of it's the way the author's going to say it and the cadence and the tone and all those things. Yeah, it was a connection I hadn't made. That's fascinating. Well, we've been talking about your poetry and your performance. Why don't we hear some of your poetry? So why don't you go ahead and introduce your piece, we've chosen ahead of time, Fargo and I, we've chosen ahead of time, he suggested a poem, and why don't you introduce it, Fargo, and we'll go ahead and read it and introduce it. Yeah, go ahead.
Sure. This is a poem called An American Writes a Poem. An American writes a poem, sells it to a university magazine run by exploited graduate students. A different American sees the poem online and buys the magazine for $22.95. Of this, a small percentage to the university, little to nothing to the graduate students, whose union is fomenting daily and with the certainty of mold. The university courts an endowment from a conservative billionaire, Certainly, says the billionaire, and drafts a quick proposal for an endowed chair of the study of international relations through the lens of finance. The chair will, in the next year, recommend a strong legal and policy response to the growing movement for a popular boycott of Israel, which an undergrad will be surveilled and suspended for supporting. The billionaire files his taxes, paying roughly 0.5% of his declared income. In the night, his teeth grind lightly as cruelty works through his system like moss. He will wake with no memory of his dreams, which were Artodian, prophetic. The billionaire's taxes go towards the production of this year's slate of U.S. weaponry and are pocketed by the financiers of major capital, their defense contracts quietly renewed. At a banquet, the financiers begin to vomit, the shellfish revolting. A percentage of this weaponry is bundled into an $800 million arms deal with the state of Israel. A new kind of infringement on life is dreamt up, written down, and revised to be voted on summarily. The arms deal pays for the restocking of an arsenal depleted during the last escalation of genocide. The arsenal received a fresh supply, some 10,000 M16A1 rifles, 350 M204 grenade launchers, 200 M2 50 caliber machine guns, and an assortment of 30 caliber, 50 caliber, and 20 millimeter ammunition, among others whose names have been redacted by the linguists. These weapons are dispersed among the various branches of Israel's occupying forces, who are, as a matter of citizenship, required to take part in the military front of the genocide. A routine settler, once they have fulfilled this requirement, begins to serve on one of the other fronts: ideological, academic, cultural, culinary, linguistic, political, social, economic, and the front of the dreaming. One of the soldiers issued a rifle which fires black sponge rounds, introduced in 2015, heavier and thus more lethal than typical sponge-tipped rounds, which are classified by the occupation forces as non-lethal, despite evidence to the contrary, clambers into his AIL Storm Border Police Jeep, produced by Automotive Industries Limited on a Chrysler license, and scrolls on his phone as the Jeep rumbles towards Aram. He sees the poem. He reads its lines to himself silently. They enact something about grief in his first language. He thinks about Brooklyn. He screenshots the poem before clambering out of the Jeep to aim at the youths throwing stones, most of which are likely repurposed rubble from bombed buildings previously understood by some to be homes. Irritated, the soldier fires a black sponge round into a child's chest, which causes massive internal bleeding that will later cause the child, my cousin, Muhi, to die. This is the place analysis ends. The soldier will go home and surrender to the dream of militant preservation. He will never think of this day again. I will think of this day constantly, imagining and reimagining the round hurtling through the wind as again an American poem just breaks somebody's heart.
Wow.
Thank you. Thank you.
Thank you.
Yeah, and as you've demonstrated, you know, I read that prior to our interview here, but hearing you recite it gives it a totally different feel, a totally different, creates a totally different atmosphere. Some great lines in there. I love the shellfish revolting.
Thank you.
That's fantastic. Wow, it's so creative. You are known for your idea of Palestinian futurity. I hope I'm saying that right. The importance of reimagining and narrating a world where everyone will be free. Why don't you explain to our audience what you have in mind or what you mean by Palestinian futurity?
Yeah, for sure. For me, I think about the ways that our advocacy and our work for a free Palestine is an imagining of a future. And at the same time, like many other indigenous movements for liberation, it's deeply connected to an idea and an embodying of the past, right? Because we know that at one time we were free, we were not colonized, we were not occupied. And so as we're moving towards a future, we're at the same time sort of paradoxically moving towards a past.
Mm-hmm.
And I think about the work that Palestinians and those who love us are doing to create liberation within our lifetime as a very expansive set of possibilities for what that might mean. So, for example, there's one version of what a free Palestine means that is a typical liberal imagining of that word and that concept, which would be perhaps a nice two-state solution. Palestine has its own independent government that takes the shape of a nation state and is therefore a kind of freedom. And that is one version of what it means to work for the liberation of Palestine. But it's not the only version. And in fact, most Palestinians and most of the people who are doing the work to move towards liberation are not imagining that. So for me, Palestine is both a place and a people and a particular land, but it's also an idea or a set of ideas about what freedom might mean, not just for us, but for all of the people in the world whose struggles are bound up with the Palestinian struggle. And constantly, every day, Palestinians are embodying different arrangements of the world that don't take the shape of a nation, for example, that don't take the shape of another president with another government that comes with another military and therefore works itself into the arrangement of the world that we already know is built inexorably on violence.
Mm-hmm.
So I think of these moments, constantly these moments that Palestinians are embodying between each other and between other groups that show us a different way to think about what the future that is based in freedom might look like. So when sieges and blockades in Gaza are particularly intense, Gazans will dispense with money for each other, right? There's a particular story of taxi drivers just refusing to take money from their fellow Gazans in order to transport each other, giving food for free, taking care of one another in ways that are not based in capital, for example. Thinking about the moment in 2014 when Black Americans were rebelling in Ferguson and Palestinians online were offering advice for how to deal with tear gas. That is an imagining of what it means to work for Palestinian freedom that says it is also connected to the freedom of other people around the world.
Yeah.
And I think for me, it's about understanding that within Palestine as a space to labor for freedom is contained all of the other ways and forms that we labor for freedom. It's about laboring against global imperialist capital. It's about laboring against the structures of ableism or of cis-hetero patriarchy. All of these are things that Palestinians are working against in their everyday lives, and they are all held within the violence that Palestinians face. So for me, the possibilities that are offered by thinking about Palestinian futurity, which is to say the vision of what we mean when we say someday Palestine will be free, it's open, it's slippery, and it's undefined. And every day we're defining it through our work with other people, through our work with other communities, and through our work with each other and ourselves. There's a writer named Sophia Azeb, whose work is really, really invaluable to me in thinking around these ideas. And she has an essay in the magazine The Funambulist, which is called Who Will We Be When We Are Free? And in it, she articulates that when we envision a free Palestine, someday our lives as Palestinians and our meanings as Palestinians will not be defined by disaster. We won't be defined by our colonization, our oppression, our marginalization. And what that means is that we get to build and create new definitions of what it means to be Palestinian in relationship to the land and in relationship to a larger world and community of people. And we have the power to make those definitions more inclusive and more capacious than they have been before. Mm-hmm. So that's, I think, the promise of envisioning the future, is to say that, number one, there will be a future, which mm-hmm. is in many ways a difficult thing to believe all the time by itself, that there is a future where we will be free. And this is the promise of future that is held within the Palestinian practice of sumud, of rootedness, of steadfastness, right? Which mm-hmm. is to say, the future is that we will still be here. And what that we means is also something that is open to our change, something that is open to our renegotiating with each other and with the world as we continue staying where we are and also changing what it means to stay where we are. So that's really valuable to me as a concept. But I also think, I don't know, for myself in my own work, a lot of the times and spaces that this manifests is in my work writing things that are speculative, writing speculative fiction, for example. And again, going back to talking about that earlier, it's a way of looking at the future in order to look at how things are now, and balancing both of those things as real, or as solid material, things that we can really envision and imagine and move towards. And I have found that it's really valuable to use that sense of futurity to also examine the kinds of hard, ugly feelings that it's difficult for us as Palestinians to talk about right now. Yeah. So, for example, thinking about earlier conversations around the kinds of performances that are required of Palestinians, one thing that I think of often is the requirement for us to be resilient, sort of quote yeah. unquote, yeah. that we are defined by how much we are able to take and still be loving and still be committed to justice, yeah. which is absolutely a truth. And it's valuable and important to think about that. At the same time, I find it important and valuable to think about those among us who don't feel that, who have not been able to take the constant beatings of the colonial world and stay whole, because yeah. many of us haven't. Yeah. And so that's a really difficult thing to articulate right now, for example, to introduce into conversations that Palestinians can be bitter and full of hatred and anger and sadness and hopelessness.
Yeah.
So for me, thinking about the future as a space that gives us more wiggle room to allow for those feelings as well, right? And to not let them be expressed in a way which gets in the way of our movement towards liberation, but is deeply part of the move towards liberation, to be able to hold those kinds of feelings that the conversation and discourse in the world right now just can't hold, right? There's just people can't take that up in a way that still allows them to be in solidarity, for example. And so for me personally, it's been really useful to think about futurity as a space where I might be able to explore what that feels like in my own body and in my own heart, and with those that I'm in community and relationship with, that need that space, or that deserve that space. So it's yeah. a bit of a long answer, but I think there's so many people who are so many Palestinian artists and thinkers who are using a concept of futurity to orient ourselves towards an undefined liberation that is open to revision and that is open to possibility.
Yeah. 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 You've made so many good points. I can't comment on all of them, but I've often had a certain caution around the word resilience. Being resilient is a luxury. It's a privilege. And I think the word is tossed around too much, and oh, they're so resilient, and not everyone can be resilient. and you know, our narrative should accommodate the inability to be resilient, yeah, as well as you know. So yeah, so much to say, but certainly I you know I'm not Palestinian myself, but I certainly understand the need to envision what will the future for Palestinians be. There will be a future, and what will it be? And it requires a lot of imagination and creativity. And I think one of the points you made earlier was, you know, that we, you know, a lot of Palestinians think of the future in terms of the past, and it doesn't really make that much sense. So what is this envisioned future? There's just so much, wow. There's so much, to say, and you have so much to say here, Fargo. We do have some other questions that I want to get to. I wanted to, talk about, I think one of your, most well-known one of your solo performances entitled My Father, My Martyr, and Me. In a review of it, I heard it talks about you and your father and also Sirhan Sirhan. And why don't you tell us a little bit about the genesis of that and sort of what you're trying to express through that piece?
Certainly. It's a performance that I've done for several years now. I first wrote it in 2018. And the genesis of it, in large part, emerged from some other performance work I was doing around that time, which was when the Great March of Return was happening in Gaza.
Right.
So I was experiencing and watching this protest unfold, as many diaspora Palestinians were, from very far away. And I started making some performance work that tried to work with or reckon with the names of Palestinians who'd been killed that year, which I think, anyway, as I started making this work, I started to feel uncomfortable with what I was doing. And I had been at the same time thinking a bit about the concept of archaeology, both as a real academic historical field of study, but also as a kind of storytelling shape that is, for me, bound up and intertwined with colonialism and the kinds of knowledge that colonialism produces. So in archaeology, you dig something up and you tell its story yourself. And right. You don't allow for a kind of agency of the dead in some ways. So essentially, as I was making my own performance work, I started to feel like I was doing something similar, that I was working with the names and stories of people who I did not have a relationship with. And I started to wonder what kinds of storytelling or performance might be able to do the opposite of archaeology. So I was thinking about the ways that, and this sort of ties to a lot of what we've been discussing, which is that the colonial world has already dug up the Palestinian dead. It has already dug up Palestinians from 100 years ago, and it's already told their stories. My story has already been told. My father's story has already been told. And it's been told in a way which reduces and flattens our humanity in order to fit us into a kind of narrative that says there is a nice linear set of progress from backwards savage Arabs to nice civilized Israel, for example. And so thinking about that process of how I had been dug up, how Palestinians had been dug up and narrated without any feedback or agency on our part, I started to wonder what a form of performance or storytelling might be that could, in fact, do the opposite and rebury us, replace us in the ground, and add back the context that makes it very difficult to simplify or reduce our lives in a way that colonialism requires. So all of this is to say, what I started to do is take a lot of ideas that I couldn't stop thinking about, that I hadn't been able to stop thinking about, and those ended up focusing around three figures that focused around myself, my dad, and Sirhan Sirhan, as you mentioned, who assassinated Robert Kennedy in 1968. And all three of these figures were in some way for me shaped and narrated within the bounds of a kind of criminality to some degree. So obviously Sirhan Sirhan exists within a historical narrative as a very particular figure of terrorism and of the incursion of a Palestinian conflict into the borders of the United States. My father is in many ways defined in the public record by his experiences with the American legal system. And thinking too then about my relationship to my father and my relationship to the world as defined by this sense of wrongness and criminality that is already always layered onto Palestinian bodies. So thinking about these three things and thinking about archaeology and how I might take our figures and add back in the detail that make us human and complex and most essentially for me worthy of love. That was the central question behind the performance, is how can I narrate the three of us in a way that opens up the possibilities for someone to love us in a way that comes with political commitments? So many times in my life, I have been in relationships with people who love me and also are not able to take up the idea of Palestine. And I think this is probably a very common experience for us, right? To say that my existence and the political, ideological things that come with it as a Palestinian American or a member of the diaspora are placed off to the side of my relationships with other people. Yeah. And for me, this is a failure of love. And what I wanted to do with the performance was to create a way for an audience of strangers to unlearn that criminality along with me, right? Something that I also needed to unlearn is the sense that my father is wrong or not worthy of love because of what he has done. That Sirhan Sirhan is not worthy of love because of what he has done. And to emerge at the end of the performance with a greater sense of possibility for how we might be in relationship with one another in ways that do not sacrifice political commitments. So that's really the dream and goal of the show. And so as part of it, it's deeply rooted in interaction, in interactive moments where I ask audiences for help with certain things. It is based in a lot of nonlinear storytelling and things that question an easy relationship between the past and the present and the future. And ultimately, it's just about looking for the ways that I can talk about myself and my dad and about Sirhan Sirhan, who is just someone that I've been, obsessed with for a long time as a historical figure, and how I can talk about the three of us in ways that do justice to the particular social, historical, and political contexts that have shaped our lives, and also render us human beings, full human beings that can be loved by someone in a way that takes up the entirety of who we are and not just bits and pieces.
Yeah.
So that's it's a show with a lot going on, so I could talk about it for a lot longer, but I'll just give that as the sort of brief description.
Yeah. No, it's it did look fascinating in terms of the clips and so on, you got to let us know when you bring it to Canada, Fargo.
Yes. Yeah, certainly.
But yeah, fascinating. And I was born in 63, and I guess Robert Kennedy was assassinated in 68. Even at my age, I'm still not old enough to really have to remember it sort of consciously. So I looked into it a little bit. But yeah, he was just always this figure where there was, he's the one that he was a Palestinian who assassinated Robert Kennedy. And that's all.
Right.
If anyone has heard of him, that's all that they've heard of. And with respect to your father, I guess I was reading another one of your poems where he said something about your father is dragged into this poem as he's been dragged into so many of the other poems. So clearly a figure that you've grappled with a lot in your art and so on. So I wish we could talk more. Well, we do want to hear, do you have any advice? I mean, you've obviously broken a lot of barriers, broken a lot of conventions and so on. What advice do you have to other young Palestinian or Arab writers, artists, performers, queer Palestinian artists? Any advice you'd give to them?
Something that was really valuable for me when I began more intentionally making art was letting go of the pressure to explain or contextualize, especially as a Palestinian who is making performance or writing poetry in America, in a place where, even though over the last couple of years, support and understanding of our history and our struggle has grown in ways that are genuinely really incredible to see, that would not have been the case even 10 or 15 years ago. Even within that world, we're living in a place in which the kinds of writing, the kinds of artistic expression that will be useful to us as Palestinians is not always the kind that will be legible to average American audiences. So that comes sometimes with a pressure to say, well, I need to explain what the Nakba is. I need to explain where this area in Palestine is, or what this symbol means in a context. And that, for me, if I had done that, it would have led to work that was very boring for me, even if it was perhaps useful to an average American audience member. It wouldn't have been useful to me. So I think that letting go of the need to explain, and with it, letting go of the pressure to think of my work as something that would convince others of my humanity and of the rightness of supporting and being in solidarity with Palestinians, has allowed me to make what I think is much better work, to make work that is more interesting, more useful to those of us who are embedded in the struggle and are thinking about what it means. So I would just say, think about who you want your audience to be and make work for them. That audience can just be yourself. That audience can be people that you love or people who love you. For me, the thing I've arrived at is just thinking that my work is for Palestinians, people who love us, and people we love. And others can engage with it, and that's great. But I am not thinking about someone who is suspicious of our work, someone who is rooted in ideologies that don't think that we deserve liberation. They're not my audience, and I don't want to make work that tries to convince them otherwise, because it would be boring work. So that was a really useful moment for me in my own work, and I would encourage others to do the same. Read widely, look at everything, follow rabbit holes, and spend some time with the rabbits that live there. There's nothing that is that needs to be unrelated to the kind of work that you do. There are so many ways that that the wideness of the world can make itself known in your work. And that's something that I think is a really valuable thing to hold on to.
Good advice. You know, your first point about letting go of the pressure to explain or contextualize reminds me of something. We had a guest earlier this year, Renan Nazal, a young woman, Palestinian Canadian artist here. And she said something very similar, that, you know, it just weighs down. There's so much weight that comes with that. And it's like, she felt so liberated. Just, you know, I'm just going to present this. And, you know, if people don't figure it out, that's okay. But I don't, you know, it's just too much to try to sort of contextualize it all. So yeah, that's a great insight. I'm sure for you is extremely liberating. I don't, you might have used that word, I don't know, but it sounded like it certainly was.
Yeah, it absolutely is, you know. And it just allows me to make work that is thinking about these things in ways that are more complicated and more nuanced and more, I hope and think, useful to all of us, right? That there's not a lot of use in just rehashing, like, the sort of representational lens, which has to ask others to think of us as humans, because if it was going to work before, it would have worked already. And the reality is that I don't think it's a useful lens to force upon ourselves to always be constantly searching for a kind of dialogue when it's not going to lead to material support for us. You know, it just isn't. So, yeah, it's hard sometimes to let go of, but I think it's very useful and very important.
Yeah. Well, and obviously it takes away from the time and the space that you have for what you really want to do, obviously. So Fargo, really, what a pleasure to talk to you. Seriously, we could have gone on quite a bit longer, but I just want to respect your time here. But really insightful reflections in just from so many different angles. So thank you very much for joining us here today. Really,
thank you for having me. It was a pleasure.
If you've enjoyed our podcast today, I'm glad you're with us through this and other podcast interviews. Hopefully our audience and you as an audience member have gained a better understanding of the Palestinian experience. I think we can certainly say that today in talking to Fargo. If you've enjoyed our podcast, please leave us a review. We'd love to hear your feedback. And of course, if you have any suggestions for future podcasts, let us know at atp@cjpme.org. This podcast is a project of Canadians for Justice and Peace in the Middle East, CJPME, and seeks to advance its mission to empower Canadians of all backgrounds to promote justice, development, and peace in the Middle East. Thanks to all our supporters who helped to make this podcast and all of CJPME's other activities possible. Time to say goodbye, but we'll be back with our next podcast next week.
Hi, this is Wilbo from the band OUI, and you're listening to 90.3 FM, CKUT, Montreal. Bonjour, Madame Sanssouci.
For the first time in Montreal, Slick Red, The Ruler, live in concert.
Well, it was one of those days.
Not much to do.
I was chilling downtown
with my old school crew.
Doing his classic hits.
Once upon a time, not long ago, when people wore pajamas and lived life slow.
Tuesday, May 21st, 2024, in Montreal, at Paradox Theater, 5959 Boulevard Monk. Tickets at rickydevents.com. Slick Red, live in concert.
Excuse me, I'm trying to earn in me a buck or two. A silent rapper come in. And who the fuck are you?
Sponsored by the Green Room, Ghana Satage.
Hydro-Québec cherche du monde pour travailler cet été comme guide dans ses centrales et centres d'interprétation partout au Québec. Du monde qui a envie de faire partie d'une équipe énergique qui contribue à changer le monde. Du monde qui souhaite vivre une expérience inoubliable qui ouvre des portes. Tu aimes t'exprimer en public et tu cherches un emploi bien rémunéré? Joins-toi à l'équipe. Postule d'ici le 3 mars au hydroquebec.com/emploi-guide.
Calypsis Tour 2024. Live at Bell Center, Saturday, June 1st. Get tickets now at eventco.ca.
What's going on, y'all? It's your girl, Miss Ben, and it's Black History Month. So you know we'll be kicking it every Tuesday right here on CKUT 90.3 FM. Every Tuesday from 3 to 5, I bring to you Heal, Black Girl Heal, where we discuss some in-depth conversations with those that got some things going on within the Black community. And let's not forget about all of the plentiful activities that you need to keep up to date with. So do not forget, each and every Tuesday for the month of February, right here on CKUT 90.3 FM.
Oui, les enfants.
Qu'est-ce qu'on va faire cette année pour la semaine de relâche?
Bien, nous allons aller glisser.
Encore?
Maman, on fait toujours ça.
Mais qu'est-ce qu'on peut faire d'autre?
Euphoria!
C'est quoi ça, Euphoria?
Euphoria offre des activités éducatives et théâtre aux enfants pour la semaine de relâche.
Oui, maman. Jeudi le 7 mars, au complexe La Providence de midi à 18h. Il y aura 10 kiosques d'ateliers gratuits. Peinture, sculpture, couture, confection de bijoux, bricoréno, jeux de société, Lego, danse, cuisine et jeux gonflables. Tout cela gratuitement.
Waouh!
Et vendredi le 8 mars, au centre Leonardo da Vinci, 2 pièces de théâtre. Le chat beauté à 13h pour les bouchous de 3 à 6 et Bookie et Malice à 16h pour les 7 à 13 ans. Seulement $30 pour adultes et enfants.
Alors, qu'est-ce qu'on fait cette année pour la semaine de relâche?
Euphoria!
Billets en vente partout et sur Eventbrite. Info 438-994-7615. 438-994-7615.
Yay!
Hola amigos, bienvenidos a nuestra emisión quincenal Escuchando América Latina, aquí en CKUT 90.3 FM.
Les informaremos a ustedes sobre el arte, la cultura, poesía y turismo.
También tenemos deportes, información actual y mucho más.
América Latina, ¿eres tú?
América Latina es ella.
América Latina es él.
América Latina somos nosotros.
Argentina,
Bolivia,
Brasil,
Chile,
Costa Rica,
Colombia,
Cuba,
Ecuador,
El Salvador,
Guatemala.
América.
Honduras,
México,
Nicaragua,
Panamá,
Paraguay,
Perú,
República Dominicana,
Uruguay,
Venezuela.
América.